on the Fight Nerd Radio.
This is the Fight Professor, Stephen Quadros, and you're listening to Fight Nerd Radio.
Hi, this is Danny the Upgrade Loventhal, and you're listening to Fight Nerd Radio.
This is Martin Kamen. You're watching the FightNerd.com. This is Nathan Africa Tour, and you just got schooled by the Fight Nerd.
See it? What is it?
The game we saw, we kicked its ass.
Not quite live from New York. You're listening to Fight Nerd Radio.
Hey, this is the Fight Nerd, and you are listening to Fight Nerd Radio. Today is August 11th, 2009, and we just witnessed UFC 101 and WEC 42, and we have plenty to talk about with just those events in the record books. And we are also on the verge of Strikeforce's potentially history-making show, headlined by Gina Carano versus Chris Cyborg, which we will talk about much later. Joining me also on this episode will be a man who just about everybody remembers all the way back from UFC 2, Fred Edish, who is making his comeback fight this weekend. We're going to talk to him and learn what drove this man back to competition after a 15-year layoff. And if you don't recognize the name, just search for him on YouTube and I'm sure you'll recognize the man as soon as you see him in action. And before that, we're also going to talk with Jeremy Padwer from Jack's Pacific Action Figures, briefly with some news on the UFC action figures and a recent deal they just made. Now, before we get into the recap from this weekend, I want to thank the people that helped me buy the ramen noodles and allow me to pay for the electricity to use my microwave to cook those ramen noodles. That would be CagesideMMA.com, HoodlumFightGear.com, FindMMAGym.com, and MMA Worldwide Magazine. Without them, I'd be a hungry nerd, and a hungry nerd is a cranky nerd. Also, I want to mention that my computer is away for repairs for at least this week, and possibly next week too, if not more. So video updates on the website are going to be sporadic, if there's any at all, in fact, until it comes back to me in new condition. And if this podcast sounds a little different from the other ones, that's because, again, of my lack of my usual computer. Nothing I can really do about that to fix it, but once I get it back, the Fight Nerd will be blasting out videos like nobody's business to make up for all the lost time, and I've got a ton of videos coming out. I've got an interview with Andre Arlovsky, Sean Shirk, Jens Pulver, Tim Kennedy, Chuck Zito even. Ton of guys from the New York Mixed Martial Arts Expo, as well as my highlight reel from the New York Mixed Martial Arts Expo, so stay tuned for that once I get my computer back up and running. Alright, so UFC 101 this weekend in Philadelphia was a record-breaking event. The sold-out show, which took place at the Wachovia Center, drew 17,411 spectators for record $3.55 million gate. This gate is a combat sports record for the state of Pennsylvania, a state that only recently began regulating mixed martial arts action, but has a rich boxing history that includes a 1926 match between Jack Dempsey and Gene Tunney, which drew over 120,000 spectators. The main event for this UFC was BJ Penn defending his lightweight title against Kenny Florian, and BJ came to win, looking marvelous in his match, choking out Ken Flo in the fourth round. Florian looked like a mess as the fight wore on. He was definitely tired, making a lot of mistakes, blowing takedown attempts, just being generally sloppy. Penn, however, was motivated, and as I talked about last week, I think that part of this motivation was just because mentally, Penn had already felt that he already had beaten Florian, and that Florian was below him. So as long as Penn feels that he can actually beat somebody, he'll be super motivated, as opposed to his fight with George St. Pierre at UFC 94. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not going to take away anything from Penn's victory here. He won that fight in every round and looked the way a champion should look in every one of those rounds. He was calculated, in shape, and controlling the pace. Once they got past the first round, it became the BJ Penn show, and Penn was easily stuffing takedown attempts and hitting hard strikes on Kenny Florian until knocking him down in the fourth round and getting that rear naked choke to finish the fighter from Massachusetts. So now, will this BJ Penn that we saw clobber Kenny Florian remain by the next time we see him fight, or will BJ revert back to the same Penn that lost to George St. Pierre and spent months whining in a court claiming that his opponent was too greasy? I, for one, hope we keep seeing this Penn in action, as I'm sure most of you will agree. This is the Penn that win fans over and keeps them coming back for more BJ. That didn't sound right, but I'm going to keep it in the podcast anyway. Dana White has also announced that Diego Sanchez will be next for the Hawaiian, so we get a really good fight to look forward to coming up when that time arrives, and we get the hope that we see the same Penn that we saw here tonight coming there to take on the Nightmare, because that's going to be an absolute war. You don't want to miss that one. The other big fight this weekend at UFC 101, Anderson Silva moved up to weight class to duke it out with Forrest Griffin. Silva looked absolutely amazing and knocked out Griffin, and doing so completely shut the fans up who had complained about his past performances. I cannot believe that I saw Anderson Silva just toying with Forrest Griffin for the duration of that short fight, knocking him down twice, not just once but twice, and letting him back up both of those times, and just taking his sweet time and picking his shots. Each time he knocked down Griffin, he got more aggressive, but remained patient, still picking his shots, and that was the key to this fight. This was definitely a big fight for Silva, and showed his dominance in the UFC at 205. if he stays in 205, he's going to be a dangerous competitor. So we might see him move up in weight potentially if he gets bored at middleweight. And if he does go up there, it's going to be serious trouble for the 205ers. Dana White has stated that Dan Henderson will be next for Silva, a rematch for the title, which was Dan Henderson's second fight in the UFC when he came back. And when they had that fight, it was an absolute dominant performance from Silva that saw Silva choking out Henderson in the first round, I believe it was. But Hendo, I think, should be able to offer a much tougher fight this time around if we do, in fact, get to see it. After this fight with Griffin, Anderson was clearly ecstatic. And Forrest Griffin, however, was clearly pissed off as he stormed out of the octagon and into the locker room. This is actually not the first time that Forrest has done this sort of thing. In fact, the first time was after losing to Keith Jardine at UFC 66. Griffin sprinted to the locker room after that fight and crying, and that was pretty much that. You know, losing sucks, plain and simple. I can't even sugarcoat that fact, and we all know losing is not a good way to feel. But Griffin is a warrior, win or lose. He's proven that in his past fights. But running out after this fight was over is just poor sportsmanship, plain and simple. Not even touching gloves or anything, not even shaking hands, just darted out of the ring. The whole fight, Silva was nothing but respectful to Griffin, bowing at the start of the match, touching gloves repeatedly during the match, although not in the beginning of the round, they didn't touch hands at the start of the fight once the bell rang. And yes, Anderson Silva did get cockier as the fight went on by putting his hands down, kind of dancing around Griffin. But other than that, was still respectful to Forrest. Despite his running out at the end of the night, Forrest is now, in fact, suffering from a dislocated jaw and partial hearing loss, allegedly, and is claiming that he ran out to seek medical attention immediately, even though there is a doctor at cage side. So I suppose you could blame maybe a mini panic attack on his part for not thinking about it, if it is, in fact, true. I figure if you're injured, though, that bad, wouldn't you be laying on your back for a few more minutes instead of darting off and letting maybe the cage side doctors attend to you and let you know what's going on? So where does this leave Forrest exactly? Well, I don't think it really hurts his rankings in his division, since this was a special attraction catchweight fight, if you will. But we could perhaps see a rematch of Forrest with Keith Jardine and see what happens in that fight. Either way, we wish Forrest a quick recovery so we can see him back in the cage soon and back to his old ways. And Anderson Silva, once again, is just looking back to being the unstoppable Anderson Silva we saw that destroyed Chris Leben and Rich Franklin and many others in the past. Some other quick thoughts on UFC 101 this past weekend. Amir Sadala versus Johnny Hendricks. There is a discussion over a quick stoppage in that fight. If you haven't seen that fight, you can check it out. And I disagree with those complaining about the stoppage. Dan Rogliata was the referee in that fight, and I believe that Big Dan did the right thing. Sadala was not defending himself, and he was on all fours, just eating blows. It did not look like he was looking to do anything. And it looked like he was maybe kind of feeling around for an ankle pick, I thought, or something on the ground. But we've seen in the past fight, you can check back in any of their fights, you've seen people get rocked before. When a fighter is dazed on the ground, they'll just typically try and cling to whatever they can to recover. I mean, you can even go back to as recent as when Kimbo Slice got knocked out by Seth Petruzzelli, and he was still basically jumping on the referee trying to take him down. Sadala was okay after the fight, and he probably could have kept going on, but what would he have done in that situation? He was being pounded on Hendricks on all fours, wasn't really doing much to help himself recover, and even if he was looking for a takedown during that flurry, Hendricks was in a prime place with enough distance not to get caught, be able to sprawl, or just move around and continue raining down blows. So no matter what, that fight pretty much would have ended, if not there, a few seconds later, around that position. I was also wrong with one of my picks last week. Well, a few of my picks last week, but I'm not going to go into that. But specifically in choosing Kendall Grove over Ricardo Almeida. Almeida shocked me by beating Kendall in a fight that was much more competitive than I also expected. And Grove, in fact, almost had Almeida, too, locking in a deep armbar that would have probably made a lot of other fighters tap out. Ricardo has said that his arm isn't bending too well right now at this point, and I can't blame him if you haven't seen that armbar. You should definitely try and find a photo or a video of that to see how deep and tight that thing was. If this is the new Ricardo Almeida, consider me on the bandwagon. I mean, I was surprised he could offer that much resistance and offense to Kendall Grove. But with all that said, he still wasn't able to actually finish Kendall, and that's something we have to keep watching for with this new Ricardo Almeida. But I'm definitely happy to see Ricardo back in the UFC and looking great. Silva and Griffin earned knockout of the night and a cool 60K, and another 60K for fight of the night. BJ Penn scored the obvious submission of the night and got his sweet 60K bonus in an event that was not one of the best UFCs ever, but at least we got to see Anderson Silva get a huge knockout victory, and at the end of the day, that's all that matters to me. It's unfortunate that, again, another lackluster UFC event was held on the East Coast. I don't know how, whenever it comes to this side of America, we keep getting these lame events. This wasn't the worst. It was by no means UFC 78, which was, ugh, I tried to repress that one for quite some time. But still, I'd like to see if they come back to this coast again, some better matches overall. WEC 42 this weekend also, on Sunday. That saw the end of many winning streaks, including Brian Bowles ending the streak of Miguel Torres. Bowles shocked a ton of people as he dethroned Torres in a dominating fashion for the WEC bantamweight title. Bowles was coming into this fight undefeated, and Torres was coming in with no losses on his record for the past 6 years. But that streak was stopped short by Bowles, who was all over Torres and not at all intimidated by the man whose record is nearly three times larger than his own. There was no luck in this fight. It was pure skill. Bowles was able to take Torres down, land blows, be aggressive on his feet, and just keep pushing the action. Torres got some good shots and defended well, but Bowles was just overwhelming him, and his performance was just on par. He got a clean knockout on the champ, and that was that. Torres does not lose any brownie points in my book for this match. The true test of a champ, of course, is what he can do when he loses. And now he's going to have to climb his way back up the ladder to get his gold back, and I think Torres can do it. The bantamweight division is super exciting in WEC, and really, honestly, all the divisions in WEC are exciting. I look forward to seeing more in Bowles and watching Torres climb back up the ladder, see if he can get that gold back around his waist. Dominic Cruz gave Joseph Benavidez his first loss as well. Cruz was looking seriously dominant and used his height to his advantage in this match, not allowing Benavidez much breathing room beyond a few haymakers here and there. And finally, the last undefeated streak to end on this WEC card, Ricardo the Bully Lamas, was beaten by Danny Castillo in a match that was borderline a kickboxing match entirely, but still very exciting. If you're a fan of MMA, you really can't not be a fan of K1 or kickboxing. So, three streaks ended on that night, but you know, everyone loses eventually, and in a sport as unpredictable as mixed martial arts, it's bound to happen. It's not the end of the world, and a true champ, of course, is tested by his losses and how he overcomes them. Like Rocky Balboa said, it's not how hard you hit, it's how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. I enjoyed WEC 42 much more than UFC 101, mainly because these smaller weight divisions just put on more exciting matches to me, with equal ferocity of the heavier weight classes. And being a smaller guy myself, I can appreciate the back-and-forth matches and the abilities of these smaller guys, much more than the heavyweights just slugging out for a few minutes. As fun as it is to watch floppy fatties punch each other in the head a few times, I much prefer to see these tactical battles that we see in the WEC. Some other news this week, Dana White, of course president of the UFC, announced that he's looking to hold a UFC in the big green monster, Fenway Park. Massachusetts State Senate passed a bill on July 22nd to regulate the sport of mixed martial arts, and a first step that could see the Octagon make its debut there by next summer. Dana White is a Boston native himself, and I'm sure he would love to get the chance to make his homecoming as soon as he can. I would enjoy that too, of course, because it would be another UFC on my coast and an event that I could possibly see live, so hooray for that. Let's make that happen, please. White also mentioned that the promotion has other potential deals in play and could add another event to its October calendar in addition to UFC 104, which is already scheduled for October 24th at the Staples Center in Los Angeles, which, oddly enough, just happens to coincide with that Strikeforce event that's looking to feature Fedor's debut, allegedly. So, let the war begin. Also, today it was announced that Spike TV will begin showing in January a Best of Pride fighting series on Spike. Not much details about that yet. It's going to be coming up in January, and that's going to be awesome. The fact that we get to see Pride FC back on TV and being shown to a whole new generation in a much bigger capacity. So I guess this is the Pride revival they've been talking about. And at least they're not trying to bring it back like WWF did with the ECW brand of their pro wrestling organization. But the fact that we're seeing old school Pride makes me very happy because Pride was awesome. Alright, some other mixed martial arts business news now. It was announced earlier last week that action figure makers Round 5 and JAK Specific have joined forces to share talent between their two companies. Joining me now to talk about the Round 5 JAK Specific deal is Jeremy Padwer, who is the Senior Vice President of Marketing in the Boys Department. Is that correct? Did I have that title right?
That's right. You got it.
That's a fancy title. What does that actually imply for that position?
Well, basically, we the third largest toy company in the U.S. in the last few years, and basically, I have the entertainment group, and specifically, we're driving towards is being the best in terms of driving boy-based products and collectibles. So, for instance, done WWE for the last approximately 12 years, and now we're jumping into UFC in a big way, Pokemon, Dragon Ball. A whole bunch of great products. We've got some great Star Wars stuff as well. But anyway, I think you're going to get the idea. We do lots and lots of great voice-driven product and collectibles.
Now, before we talk about this new deal that's happening, can you tell us a little background about the history of JAK Specific and UFC joining forces? How long has this been in the process?
It seems like a long time. It's been at least it seems like it's been almost 2 years that we've been working together towards a license agreement. It's probably been approximately a year since we formalized our relationship. And, you know, when we came into this, the market was a little bit fragmented in that, you know, UFC has become a mainstream major top four sports promotion in a lightning-fast amount of time. And because of that speed, things like merchandising were sort of something that they'd have to consider quickly as they sort of grew. And luckily we got in at a time when it would make a lot of sense for them to start considering that. And but when we walked in, there were still a lot of fighter agreements that we had to all sort of work together to consolidate this program. And so at this point, the round deal gets us access to, you know, a significant portion of the overall MMA talent base.
Yes, right. So now that we're basically at the point where there's two different companies producing mixed martial arts figures, and now they're joining forces. That's pretty much the deal that's going on right now. Can you give us a little bit more explanation of what this deal is specifically between Round 5 and JAX Pacific?
Well, JAX is going to have access to the talent pool, if not all, a significant portion of the talent pool at Round 5 this time. And Round 5 will have access to the UFC and JAX signed talent pool, which basically gives us both really the uber majority of available talent. There is no real opportunity for someone else to enter into this marketplace and develop product without any of the A-level talent. So, you know, the first objective was to consolidate. And then the second objective is to now look at product and figure out a way that we don't compete head-to-head on the same aisle, but actually complement each other in terms of the product we're putting in the marketplace. So what you're going to find from JAX is that we're reaching out to collectors, but we're doing it in more of a play-oriented way. So our figures have articulation. We're doing the real-scale octagon where you can actually play out the world of MMA. We're looking to reach the collector and the $1.5 billion action figure marketplace. Approximately 35% are adult collectors, and if you drill it down and go to a brand specific level, there are certain brands that are 60-70% adult collector. So with that said, we expect UFC to be that. So we're doing play collectibles, and we're doing truly authentic, remarkable action figures in the traditional sense. Whereas Round 5 is more geared towards the slave collectibles. The objective is not necessarily to take their pieces and reenact the battle, but to take their pieces and have them on the shelf as really a beautiful representation of the athlete. And between the two categories that we sub-licensed out to Round 5 and what we're doing from a play perspective, I think that it's going to be really an awesome statement at retail and in the best interest of the MMA collector.
Now, who initially reached out to who to get this deal going?
Oh, you are good. I'll give you that much. originally, JAX Pacific, in a sense, reached out to pretty much all parties. This is definitely, you know, UFC is in a remarkable position. They have a brand that is just incredible and performing beyond anything I've ever seen in terms of a sports organization. Round 5 was truly entrepreneurial in the way they went and approached this category, and something that I don't think anybody could replicate now. But in a sense, they went out and signed athletes, and they were able to get A-level athletes. For us, we had the license with UFC. It was our objective to basically work with UFC in Round 5 in a way where JAX is clearly the master toy, but Round 5 has some access to all the athletes to produce UFC authentic product in certain categories, and Round 5 is going to do a terrific job, and so will we. And I would have to say that we sort of originated the objective of consolidating this category.
Okay, now with this open access between both your companies, are we going to see any Strikeforce figures coming into JAX Pacific, since Round 5 has deals with Gina Carano, Kung Lee, to name a few people in Strikeforce, and of course Fedor now. Is there any chance we might see any of those characters in the near future in a JAX Pacific format?
Yeah, you know, anything is possible. I wouldn't, you know, I mean, if anything, what I've always been really good at is working with, varied organizations, and I don't necessarily look at an organization just because they're a billion-dollar company and value them more than a company that's smaller. So I wouldn't necessarily rule that out. I would say that my perspective is more about the athlete and less about the organization at this point. So, for instance, we will be working to develop product for all of the athletes. It may be that it's more of an MMA collectible versus associated with an organization other than UFC. So we would still brand it UFC.
Okay, now you were pivotal in getting a lot of figures for the WWE Classic Superstars line. Can you tell us about any possible new acquisitions coming up for the UFC figures?
Oh, man. Let me just tell you this. I mean, one thing we do with WWE is we canvassed that market, and we signed up as that were A-level, B-level, C-level. Our objective was to truly kind of own that space, and I would say that we're going to replicate that here. So if you've ever had a fight in a UFC or Pride or WEC event, and you're associated with the UFC or we have the opportunity to sign you, then you could expect to potentially be part of this opportunity. Moreover, if any of the other organizations that are out there, if it's a better one on athletes, we have no problem associating them from our branding perspective.
Okay, now I am a collector of those classic superstar figures, and I will be a collector of these UFC figures, and I, as a fan, have a few concerns I'd like to see if you can answer for me today.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you're in trouble now, Jeremy. You're in trouble now. All right, my first question is, this has been a problem for me, too. I've always had a little problem with the number of body sculpts that we've seen in the action figures previously in WWE. Are we going to be getting multiple body types, or kind of just maybe like a body type for each weight class, and that'll be it?
No, you're definitely going to get multiple body types. I mean, the action figure universe is ever evolving. And, the Classic Superstars line and some of the things that we did and started developing in early 2000, you can't just replicate that now in the late, in 2009, 2010 and expect to have the same result. So we're definitely willing to put more into the body sculpts and tooling and stuff like that in order to make sure that we reach the ever authentic, demanding consumer, and they should be.
Yes, we definitely are. I'll give you that. Another question I've got for you also, pertaining to the body sculpts, will the figures have different heights? Because that's also been a problem in previous Jax figures as well, where you have a smaller pro wrestler who's basically the same height as a guy who's easily 200 pounds heavier. Are we going to be seeing different body heights in the figures as well?
Yeah, what we're doing is we're doing a matrix, basically, where we're going to break it up into probably three or four standardized heights. The objective would be if a guy who's 6'5 would never be the same height as a guy who's 6'1, who would never be the same height as a guy who's 5'10, who would never be the same height as a guy who's 5'6. And I think that we'll do a much better job at achieving that as we move forward.
All right, and moving forward, are there going to be any other sizes of UFC action figures? Right now you have the Deluxe Aggression-style bodied figures, which are about a little more than 6 inches. Are there going to be any smaller ones, larger ones? Any plans moving ahead for those?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first of all, Round 5 is going to be doing a really nice large display piece. But we're going to definitely reach and do other scales, and we'll be presenting that at the October Play Fair when we meet with the retailers around that time. So definitely, we're going to spread our wings beyond the traditional 6-inch figure sculpt.
Okay, now, just a little off-topic now. You also are going to be doing you have the license for the TNA action figures as well. That's going to be starting next year, is that correct?
Yeah, fall 2010.
Okay. When are we going to see some protos for that? Because we're dying to see some of that stuff going on also.
Oh, man. So basically, my gut instinct is that it'll probably be into 2010 before protos are out there. We are going to be showing October Toy Fair to sell in for fall, and so as part of the general course of selling, it could well be that there's some imagery that's available as a result of that.
All right, so any TNA fanboys, you can hold your drool just for the time being. I've got one more question off the topic of the UFC figures in your deal right now. My friend is a big D'Lo Brown fan, and D'Lo is scheduled to be in an upcoming line, but he's got a little worries that it might not make it to the end with the license that you have at WWE. Is D'Lo going to be made? Will he be a happy camper?
I don't want to say. I don't I want to say, let's just put it this way. I think that without me specifically answering your D-Lo question, because I don't want to break anybody's heart right now, but let me just tell you this. We have, if you count the number of the number of classic superstars that we've done, not duplicates or body styles or types, individual characters, I think that this is probably one of the most comprehensive tribute lines, if not the most, ever.
Definitely.
So there will be, at the end of a license, a few guys who fall through the cracks. We're still finalizing, you know, how that works right now. And it sort of breaks my heart to not say that we, you know, to say that we didn't achieve, you know, complete mastery of the history of that genre. But I'd say that we got pretty darn close.
I definitely agree.
I think there could have been a classic superstars 50 if we could have maintained and held on to the deal. But now it's on to other opportunities.
And that will be the UFC figures that are coming out. Now, can you tell us what are going to be the first lineups for the UFC figures? You got three waves coming out. You've got two types of octagon cages. You got championship belts also. Give us a rundown of what we can wait to see this Christmas, I guess.
Well, you know what? We're going to have two waves out by the end of this year. So the first wave will be on shelves at Walmart and at Toys R Us approximately mid-October. The second wave will be on shelves approximately by mid-December at all accounts. The actual wave rollout I don't have in front of me right now, but you can expect some best athletes like Lesnar, GSP, etc., to be out there. Our ultimate objective is to have a very broad line to represent all the A plus A, B level talent, and definitely reach out to guys who maybe even had one or two fights that just were memorable. The other product that will be out this year will be the basic octagon, which is a play piece. The real scale octagon, which is going to be an amazing display and play piece. The authentic belts, and I know that you guys are really familiar with that, our style of doing belts. And finally, I think you're going to really dig the packaging. And that's really important on a collector brand, because a lot of the times consumers, as you know, in this world, you know, mint on card and then one to play with. And, you know, it's something I can relate to. And we're doing a beautiful job in packaging to make sure that from a mint on card collector perspective, you're going to have something really nice to put to display in your collectible segment of your home.
All right, so one last question for you now. Which fighter have you worked with that's given you pretty much the hardest time in making his action figure?
Oh, man.
I know there's probably a lot of picky guys.
I'd have to take a dig at somebody. But I'd have to take a dig at somebody that I like a lot. But I'm going to tell you that the hardest, and I'll just make it the hardest ever. How about that?
All right, we'll go with that. That's fine, too.
Ever.
Semantics.
No, you know what? It's funny. It's going to sound like a little bit of a cop-out, but I really don't think that we've had that hard of a time dealing with any individual athlete. I think that for the most part, you know, we've done a pretty good job at representing, you know, who they are, and certainly, you know, again, it's an evolving market, and a lot of the guys who are, you know, in their mid and late 20s who are not necessarily traditional action figure collectors see the representation of themselves, and it's so far beyond that they imagined that it would be based upon their experience as a child and playing with action figures, that it just goes well beyond their expectations. So I've had some run-ins over the years, and I've had some phone calls, and I've had some disappointments, but for the most part, it's all been really good.
All right, well, we'll be looking forward to those UFC figures coming out towards the end of this year. You can check out Jeremy's blog at jeremy.com. Right now it's under maintenance, but it'll be back and running soon, I hope.
Yeah, I'll get that back up and going. Thank you for mentioning that.
Yeah, I gotta hustle to get that going. The fans are dying for it. All right, so thank you very much, Jeremy, for being here. You can keep up with the news about the Jack specific action figures and Round 5 figures on our website. Jeremy, thanks again for being here. So now you know the rest of the story, and we will continue to speak with officials from Jack Specific and Round 5 as the release dates for their action figures draw nearer. We're going to take a little break now from the show, and when we return, we're going to talk with Fred Edish, so stick around, you don't want to miss that. Fight Nerd Radio is sponsored by Cageside MMA, carrying brands from around the world such as Triumph United, Clinch Gear, Twins, Wendy, and Bad Boy, as well as their own well-crafted brand of Cageside MMA products, CagesideMMA.com is your internet superstore for all MMA gear and apparel. Battle-tested and fighter-approved, you won't find better quality or better service from any other site carrying their variety of gear, apparel, and workout equipment. Head over to CagesideMMA.com where you can shop 24/7 or call 919-477-1999 Monday through Friday. If you don't, you'll regret it. CagesideMMA.com. And we're back on Fight Nerd Radio. Joining us now is a man that's synonymous with old school UFC. Chances are you've seen his fight at some point. He's going to be making a comeback very soon, which will be next weekend. Joining us now is Fred Edish. Fred, thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
So, first question, where is the mustache?
The mustache went down the drain a number of years ago, and don't look for it to make any kind of a comeback itself.
Alright, we're going to miss that mustache then. Alright, well, in the meantime, y'all are preparing for a big fight coming up against your opponent, who is the dreaded TBA, or sometimes TBD. Do you happen to know who your opponent is yet, by the way?
No, I've had two names thrown at me. It could be one or it could be the other. I'm not exactly sure yet.
Alright, now how is training? Where are you training right now? I think you're with Brock Larson, right?
No, Brock's one of my best friends, but he's up in Minnesota, and I moved down to Kansas City, Missouri about 5.5 years ago. I have my own gym. I'm a Miletich Fighting Systems affiliate instructor. I've got some guys in the gym that push me pretty hard because they're younger, they're bigger, they're stronger, and I'm an old guy. But I've got some great wrestlers, some good stand-up guys, some really good jiu-jitsu guys, so... I'm pretty much staying at home and getting ready for this on my own with my guys here. And conditioning is something that is one of my areas of specialty that I consider. So hopefully I have everything covered.
So what's a typical training routine for you every day?
Well, every day varies a little bit, but on the average, I run a lot. When I run, getting ready for anything really intense, I do a lot of hill running. I do a lot of interval sprints when I run. Mixed in between there, I'll do some distance running, but I really like to do hills and intervals to really get my fight cardio up. I hit mitts a lot, spar hard two or three times a week, do some jiu-jitsu, some kind of conditioning every day. I still practice my traditional martial arts and some of the conditioning that goes along with that as well. So the whole thing is pretty well-rounded milieu, and I'm hoping I've got all the basics covered.
Now, you're 54 years old, right?
53, that's not
53. Great. Okay, I was close.
Yeah, I'll be 54 in October.
Okay, so what's been the hardest part for your body to get used to training again at that age?
Well, I've never stopped training, so it's not a factor of getting used to it per se. The things that I notice the most now as compared to, 20 or 30 years ago is I get out of shape faster if I slack off a little bit. It takes me longer to get the conditioning back. Sleep is more important than it used to be, getting good quality rest for my body. Healing takes a little bit longer. If I get dinged up a little bit, the body doesn't bounce back quite as quickly as it used to be. Reflexes maybe just a tad bit slower, although that does come back the harder I push in the gym. But I still find myself every once in a while getting to the point where I see openings that I can't quite get there as quickly as I used to, or I see things coming at me and I don't quite move as quickly as I want to. So. Other than that, I'm in pretty phenomenal shape physically.
What weight class is this fight going to be contested at?
It sounded like they wanted me around 165 for this. It'll be a catch weight fight. I walk around somewhere in the mid to upper 160s anyway, so that won't be a problem for me. I told them I could go down to 55 if they wanted, or I'd fight up as much as at 170, but I wouldn't want to fight any heavier than that since I walk around actually under 170.
Now, the last time we actually saw you in the cage was way back at UFC number 2. Now, what brought you back to be fighting inside the cage again?
Well, that's a long story, basically. I'll try and...
We got time. Don't worry about that.
I'll give you the Reader's Digest condensed version. After UFC 2, obviously, that stung quite a bit. It hurt me a lot more internally than externally. I always had a lot of regrets, not necessarily for going and competing in the UFC, but for the performance that I gave, not representing myself, not representing my training, my teachers, my style, to the degree that I felt comfortable with. So I was always driven to go back, and I was already 38 years old at UFC 2, so it wasn't like I had a whole lot of time. I guess I felt that if I was going to come back, I needed to do it. Now, you know, this is kind of the last chance. I know I'm in really good shape, mentally, physically, psychologically. I'm feeling real good in all aspects. But I'm also a realist, and I understand that this isn't going to last forever. My body's going to start slowing down and not allowing me to do the things that I can currently do, and that day's not too far off. Trying to make comebacks before, something always got in the way. It was kind of weird because there was quite a few times that I made overtures to different people, or different people made overtures to me to come back, and one thing or another always got in the way.
So I remember there were some rumors saying you were trying to get into the Yama pit fighting show, even.
Yeah, last year, I tried to get into Yama, but they never had another show. I called Bob Monrowitz after the first show, and he didn't remember me from the early UFCs, and it was just kind of like, oh, okay, don't call us, we'll call you, I've got your number down, and yeah, we'll see about it, and then nothing ever came of it.
What other shows have you been trying to get into?
I had some tragedy in my life that I was out of the saddle for quite a few years as far as trying to get anything done competitively. But all that's behind me now, and now is the time. It's kind of a now or never thing. If I don't do it now, it's not going to happen. I'm pretty driven to at least even my record at 1-1. It's for me as a man, as a marshal, to go out there and then either even my record, or if I don't be successful at that, at least I'll know I tried, and I gave a good representation of who I really am.
Aside from Yama, what other companies are you trying to get fights with?
Ultimate Athlete had a show some years ago. Clyde Gentry III got involved with that. They had a magazine, and they had a show. That's the one that sticks out in my mind. I did write back to the UFC after UFC 2 and remind them that they had promised me a return fight, but I never did hear back from them. That was back, not the current owners, not with Zuffa, but back with the old SEG and WOW Promotions.
Now, what initially brought you to the UFC in the first place?
The challenge. I didn't see any real competitive challenges in martial arts. Point fighting tournaments, those things drove me crazy. I never liked them, even though I did a few of them to support people who were holding the tournaments. But I found them to be completely unrealistic. Just a lot of garbage, in my opinion. I saw that there was this thing called the UFC. I think it was in Black Belt Magazine. Somebody said, well, gee, you should do that. This is something that's just kind of tailor-made for the way you fight. And I said, okay, wrote a letter to Art Davey. First he said no. The card was full. Then they came back and said that Kenny Shamrock hurt his hand or broke his hand. They put Johnny Rhodes into his spot. Rhodes was an alternate, and I took Rhodes' alternate place. And that was less than 2 weeks before the fight.
What did you expect initially coming into the UFC? I mean, you had seen the first tournament on TV, right?
No, I hadn't seen it. I just read about it in the magazine.
So what did you actually expect coming into the tournament itself? I mean, without actually having seen it before, just kind of hearing things and reading about it.
I just expected it to be a pretty hardcore fight.
And in fact, when you actually were at the show, you weren't really expecting to be fighting. In fact, I understand you were there as like a fight wrangler at some points during the show, just kind of helping keep things together backstage.
Yeah, that's what it turned out to be. I had asked Art Davey before I went down there under what circumstances I would get to fight. And what I was told was that only if somebody got hurt or injured before the fight, and it was a Friday show, and the Thursday night before the fight, everybody was there, everybody was healthy, it didn't look like there was any problems. Mark came up to me and said, gee, okay, it was good that you came down, we appreciate you helping us out, but we're not going to be using you, just come on over to the show and enjoy yourself, basically. I did that on Friday, went over there to the show, and things were pretty chaotic. The venue had been moved at the last minute. Initially, it was supposed to be at McNichols Arena and ended up at Mammoth Gardens. And there was an insufficient amount of space for fighters to get warmed up, to get changed, and that kind of thing. And Art had asked me if I would help him get the fighters up to the staging area so they could get walked out to the cage on time so the show would run smoothly since it was on a pay-per-view. And that's what I was doing when Jorge and Gracie cornered me and asked me if I was ready to fight because Frank Homaker hurt his hand and didn't want to continue. Nobody had mentioned the eventuality of, gee, what's going to happen if in this tournament somebody wins a fight but they're injured and can't continue, because that didn't happen in UFC once, and nobody had ever discussed it, at least not to my knowledge.
That's right, and then, of course, the fight itself, which is history at this point. Now, speaking of that fight...
Yes, it sure is.
Yeah, I don't want to get too much details. I mean, people want to see it, they can check it out on YouTube pretty easily. And that's what I talk about.
Disappear, but I know in this day and age it never will.
Yeah, welcome to the internet. It's not a fun place sometimes.
Yeah, it's got its ups and its downs.
Now, you know, on the internet especially, you know, you've become sometimes the butt of many jokes. There's been a lot of negative criticism towards you. How do you handle this as a person to see these kinds of things said about you?
Well, initially I didn't even have the internet after, back in the old days, 1994, 95. I didn't have internet. Some friends of mine did, so I'd get little trickles of information. When I actually did get access to the internet, I was pretty surprised at the severity and the amount of ridicule and the criticism that I was getting. And criticism by itself isn't a bad thing. I can handle criticism. I'm a big boy, and you know, I realized better than anybody that I did a very poor job, and I was much harder on myself than anybody could have been on me. But I expected that it would just, you know, people would forget about it and it would go away, and it never seemed to. People created websites, all mocking and ridiculing me. Everything was done anonymously. I'd get anonymous emails. I'd get anonymous phone calls. And for quite a while, it really got to me. It made me very angry, very bitter. I called some people out to try and get them to expose themselves, and told them that, you know, if they wanted to make fun of me, if I was no good of a fighter, you know, here's my address, come and meet me, or give me your address, and I'll come and meet you, or I'll be at such and such a show. I've been to hundreds of shows. And never one time has anybody come up to me and ridiculed me or challenged me or anything like that. It's all been done anonymously. And over time, I guess I grew a thicker skin, decided that, you know, that there's really nothing that I can do to change people's ideas and opinions of me. And in the grander scheme of things, their opinions and ideas about me really don't matter. It's who I am inside. It's what I think of myself inside as a man, as a human being, as a martial artist, that really matters. And the few people that are close to me that I care about and respect enough to care about their opinions, that's what matters. And so it was a long process, though. It was very difficult for a long time.
Despite all that criticism, you still stayed very interested in mixed martial arts. What kept you so interested in it to stay involved in the sport?
I've been a martial artist since 1969, and
way before I was born.
Yet today, and I will be a martial artist until the day I die. I became involved with MMA, mixed martial arts, NHB, whatever one wants to call it. Obviously, back in UFC 2, and despite my experience, I believed in it as a sport. I think it's a wonderful sport. I think it's evolved into something that, for better or worse, if it's not mainstream, it's awful close. I still think it's the best way that a person can physically challenge him or herself, and also psychologically, and to test their heart. There's really no thing that I can think of, short of being in war, that would test you and expose to you who you really are as getting in a cage and hearing the door close and knowing that, yeah, you, there's only one way out. You've got to do the best that you can do, and you've got to fight that other person in there. Now, of course, today there's a lot of rules and regulations and restrictions, but it still, well, far surpasses anything else that I can think of. And to me, there's a lot of beauty in that. You have to be intelligent. You have to have heart. You have to have conditioning. You have to have strength. You have to have cardio. You've got to be cool under fire. You have to change from one thing to the other so rapidly. To me, there's just nothing else out there that can match it as a sport. And I felt that way from the beginning. I felt that way all the way through, and I still feel that way now.
Now, aside from the rules and the cross-training, what has changed for MMA since you first started competing in this?
Well, I think that the fighters now are a lot more athletic than they were in the beginning. I think in the beginning, there were fighters, and there weren't a whole lot of real athletes. There were a few. Now we've got fighting athletes. We've got people that take this sport very, very seriously and are able now to devote a lot more time to it, because we're getting to the point where at least some of these more elite fighters can make a living good enough to where they don't have to go out and work a 9-to-5 job and then do their training in the evening. Obviously, you know, the grassroots people still have to do that, but now there's a lot more training available also. Back in the beginning, there were no MMA gyms. There were judo gyms, there were karate dojos, there were boxing gyms, there were wrestling rooms, kickboxing, things like that, but nobody was really training MMA. Now, there's all kinds of them out there. Now, some good, some not so good. But I think those are the main differences. Now people are a lot more athletic to complement their fighting, and that the level of training out there is just so much higher than it ever used to be.
Now, with that said, what do you see for the future of mixed martial arts? What's going to be the next evolution in the sport?
Well, that's hard to say. I really can't say. I just hope it continues to grow in popularity and acceptance. Hopefully it will, now that the sport is being practiced on a very wide scale, and hopefully that all of us that are involved in MMA will do everything that we can to get it accepted. And there's still a stigma out there, a lot of ignorance, a lot of people don't understand what MMA really is. They think that it's just a bunch of thugs beating each other up. It's barbaric. You still hear terms like human cockfighting, you know, human dog fighting, you know, ignorant statements like that. And I'm hoping that we can continue to get that stigma and erase it and dispel all of those myths and show people that what we do is really something that is beyond anything else that anybody is doing as far as athletics go. And that the people that are doing it are good people, they're respectful people. The only aggression that they see is in the ring. They're not a bunch of thugs and criminals and jerks, but they're sportsmen, they're martial artists who do the best that they can do to win the contest, but when the contest is over, they act like gentlemen or gentlewomen, whatever the term for a lady gentleman is, I guess.
And it is pretty funny thinking, you know, you were fighting back in UFC 2, here we are now, over a decade later, and, you know, we still have MMA not legal in all 50 states. I'm in New York, and it's still not legal here. We're still battling for that. We still have people who don't really know what they're talking about in commissions telling us why we can't have it here. I mean, I'm hoping one day we can get it legal in all 50 states. What do you think it's going to take to actually make this happen?
Just what I said before, I think we just have to be persistent in how we represent ourselves. We have to persist in showing people that it's a good sport, it's a regulated sport, it's a safe sport. People are not dying in huge numbers like the predictions were in the beginning. There's been I don't have the statistics. I don't know. There's like, what, one or two deaths in MMA? It's been far more than that in boxing. You have far worse injuries that are career-ending injuries in things like football and hockey. We've got a great sport. We've got a beautiful sport. We've got a sport that we're trying very hard to form in a way that is acceptable to athletic commissions and to the public at large. And I think if we package ourselves correctly, if we're consistent in how we represent ourselves and represent our sport to these commissions and to the public, that sooner or later everybody's going to have to get on board with it. The popularity of this thing, people, even if they're not involved directly in the sport, if they're only involved as spectators, I think they need to get on board, and they need to talk to their political representatives, to talk to the athletic commissions and people like that, and say, hey, we want this in our state because, you know, it's a great thing, it's not a bad thing, and, you know, it's being accepted everywhere else. Why can't we have it too?
Yep, definitely. Now, you also mentioned you're a traditional martial artist. What traditional martial arts do you do right now?
I continue to do the same art that I did back in UFC 2. It's called Shorin Ryu Matsumura Kempo. It's Okinawan style. And it's something, again, that I will do until I draw my last breath.
Now, with Ultimate Fighting and MMA becoming so popular, do you think this is going to cause a decline in traditional martial arts?
Well, I think it probably already has. Again, I don't have statistics in front of me or anything. I can't really speak too intelligently to that. But I think it doesn't necessarily have to, but it probably will. That might be due in part to some closed-mindedness and ignorance on the part of some traditional martial artists or so-called traditional martial artists. There's a lot of martial arts out there that's labeled as traditional that, in my opinion, is not. It's has been modernized and bastardized and turned into something so far removed from what it was intended to be that it's turned into garbage. But I think if a traditional martial arts dojo has people within it that want to practice MMA or want to compete in MMA, then they should be allowed to do so and encouraged to do so. I think that they should also realize that if their art is not addressing some of the areas that their student might need to have addressed to be successful, that they would refer them to go out and get the extra training that they need. But I don't think traditional martial arts is ever going to go away, but I think that now with the popularity of MMA, there's a lot more, especially young people, who want to practice MMA because that's what they see, that's what they understand.
All right, now, as a fan, who are some of the fighters that you like to watch on TV?
Oh, man, there's so many great fighters out there. I think people like George St. Pierre, Anderson Silva, Lyoto Machida, those guys are cream of the crop. I'm a big fan of Fedor. I think he's another guy that represents, you know, the kind of a personality and the type of characteristics that we should try and hold up as, hey, this is what a martial artist looks like. All these guys that I'm talking about. I think Pat Miletich is a great, not only fighter, but a great person and a great human being. There's just so many of them out there. My friend Brock Larson, I think so highly of him. And I could go on and on and on. I mean, there's just so many really, really good fighters out there that I think are doing a wonderful job, not only inside the cage, but outside the cage.
Now, you mentioned Pat. Pat Miletich just had his comeback fight not too long ago. Do you know if he's looking to get back in the cage again?
I've understood that he had that idea. I don't know where he's at right now for that, but my understanding was that he wanted to do another fight or two.
So what do you think about Pat coming out basically out of retirement and going back in? I mean, there's a lot of fighters, especially now, who are retiring or have retired and coming out of retirement. They're kind of just going back and forth. What do you think about being the right time to retire is? I mean, how does a fighter decide that?
I think a fighter has to decide that by how they feel. What is their body allowing them to do or not allowing them to do? And the fighter sometimes is the best judge of that. Sometimes the fighter needs to listen to people that are close to him and say, you just probably should stick to training people and being a coach or contributing to the sport in other ways, because it's not safe for you, and you know, it's not in your best interest to continue. But I think most people, if they're honest with themselves, will realize that, you know, I just don't have it anymore. It's time to walk away and not linger too long and take the risk of maybe getting hurt unnecessarily.
All right, now, win or lose, after this fight, what's going to be next for Fred Edish?
As far as competition goes?
Yep.
That I don't know. I'm going to wait. I'm going to see how this goes, and then I will make that determination afterwards. How I feel afterwards, how I felt during the fight, the results of the fight, all these things are things I'll have to take into consideration. And like I just said, I'll sit down with people that I trust and people who I respect and ask them to give me an assessment. Does it look like I'm shot? Does it look like I have anything left at all? And then I'll have to sit down with myself and, you know, get quiet somewhere and decide, you know, this felt good or this didn't feel good. I feel like I can do this again, or maybe it's time to just say, well, okay, then my time has passed and it's time to walk away.
All right, so tell our listeners at home where they can find out more information about your upcoming fight.
My upcoming fight, as far as I know, the only place we can find information on it right now is at brocklarson.com. I don't know that it's anywhere else on the internet, but it's Cage Fighting Extreme in Brainerd, Minnesota, on 15th of August.
All right, and I know you got a few people you want to thank also, so let her rip right now. Tell us who your sponsors are and who you want to thank for getting ready for this fight.
First and foremost, I want to thank the people I forgot to thank in another interview that I did. My wife, Pam, who has been marvelously supportive of me doing this, and without her support, I would not be able to do this. Brock Larson, Gavin Rydell from Merck Management, some sponsors that I have here, Nationwide Loan and Liquidation, John Seredich, ringsandcages.com, Chad Sullivan, The Cabin Coffee House and Cafe in Bemidji, Minnesota, and that's way up north of Minnesota. Mike Phillips from Century 21 All-Pro here in Kansas City, Gustafson Chiropractic, who helps keep these old bones in shape and keeps me able to keep doing what I do. Big thanks to MMA TV, the Underground Forum, and Keurig Genis, and the fight dentist, Dr. Andrew Persky, who was kind enough to provide me with a custom mouth guard, state-of-the-art mouth guard that is going to be something that's very important. Thank you to Dr. Persky. All my guys at the gym, John Ott, Henry Chinuma, Jason White, Quint Doan, all the guys that to come in here, and for the most part I was training them, but now they're helping to get me ready, and so they're putting themselves on the back burner for me, and I really appreciate that.
Alright, well, Fred, if you ever win an Oscar, just mention this episode of the podcast if you're running out of time to talk about your sponsors. Thank you very much for your time today, and good luck in your upcoming fight.
Thank you for your time, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Alright, thank you, and we'll be right back.
Hey.
Fight Nerd Radio is sponsored by Hoodlum Fight Gear. Check out their gear and apparel at hoodlumfightgear.com. Also by Boston Brawler. Whether you're a Red Sox or a Yanks fan, you can't deny good designs. Check out bostonbrawler.com. And also by findmmagym.com. Looking for an MMA gym near you? Head to the best site to find your new place to train at findmmagym.com. And we are back on Fight Nerd Radio, and you just heard from Fred Edish. If you want to check out his fight and live in Minnesota, or will be in the area on August 15th, head to Bada Bing's. Doors open at 6:30 p.m., and Jens Pulver and Brock Larson will also be in the house. And it's always a good idea to come support these smaller shows, even if you don't know who the fighters are. It's a great way to meet the fans, talk with the fighters, meet some bigger-name fighters, and help these smaller shows grow, because more MMA is the best way to have any MMA at all. This weekend, Strike Force is holding its event in the HP Pavilion Center in San Jose, California, and is headlined by Gina Carano versus Chris Cyborg for the first ever 145-pound women's title in Strike Force. And this will be a huge step in making women's mixed martial arts part of mainstream mixed martial arts. This has been a hectic card being put together, and thankfully for them, Affliction's death was their gain, as several of their fights that were in jeopardy of being called off got saved by the Affliction guys. We have four title fights going on this show, and the one everybody is talking about, and the one that I've been dreading to make a pick for weeks now, is Gina Carano versus Chris Cyborg for that women's title. Now, pending they both make weight, and that's a big if, this will be the toughest fights of their career without a doubt, and we're going to see the best Gina and the best Chris we've ever seen in the cage. Cyborg is an absolute beast, and her size is going to be a big part of this fight, but I don't think she's going to be able to defeat Carano. I see this fight going past the first three rounds and into the championship rounds, in fact, and by then I expect to see a very tired Cyborg start to get picked apart by Gina Carano, either winning with a submission very late in the fight or winning a decision. But this will not be an easy fight by any means for either of these two women. I really don't like making picks at all, and this is one of those fights that I really just want to enjoy for the war that's going to be. The winner of this fight is, of course, important, but what's more important is if these women play by the rules, make weight, and make history, and that's going to be really the best part of seeing this fight happen. In a last-minute addition to the card, replacing the heavyweight title fight, is going to be Renato Babalu Sobral defending his light heavyweight title against Gerard Musashi. This is, again, another tough fight to call, but I'm going to go with Musashi to add another belt to his growing collection of gold. This man is unstoppable right now, and I don't see any way that Babalu is going to be able to stop that momentum coming into this fight. Musashi is the next Fedor, and he has not even really begun to hit his peak yet. He's only, I believe, 1 year older than I am, and his record is nearly as big as Fedor's now, I believe, too. So watch out for him in this fight. He's going to be going places, and this Strikeforce title is probably going to be the next one he adds into his rack of title belts. Nick Diaz will defend his welterweight title against former Affliction fighter Jay the Thoroughbred Herron, Long Island native. And I would normally not actually pick against Jay Herron, but Diaz is on fire lately, and this fight is going to be, in my opinion, probably one of the fights of the nights. I'm going to go for Diaz here, who's coming off over big, big, big wins over Frank Shamrock and Scott Smith. And with a knockout or TKO over Jay Herron, I see that being the ending. But I don't see it being the ending of Jay Herron. I would also not mind being proven wrong in this fight and seeing Herron take the gold home. I'm just really looking forward to this and getting a chance to see Herron back on a TV screen to begin with. But I do have a feeling that if Diaz survives the drug tests, of course, pre- and post-fight, that this is going to be a definite war, and he's got a good chance of holding on to that belt. And finally, the last title fight on the card is going to be Gilbert Melendez versus Mitsuhiro Ishida for the lightweight title. Ishida is replacing Josh the Punk Thompson, who is out due to a hand injury. And I like Ishida, but I don't think he's going to be able to offer too much against Melendez other than a lot of heart. Melendez has been training hard for his revenge match against Thompson, and I think this is going to end with him having his arm raised by the end of this fight as well. Ishida is coming in a little too last minute. I just don't really see him be able to offer too much trouble against Melendez, really. So, again, these are my picks for the four title fights. Carano, Musashi, Diaz, and Melendez. And with those picks, that's going to wrap up this episode of Fight Nerd Radio. I want to thank my sponsors again for helping me make this show. CageSideMMA.com, HoodlumFightGear.com, FindMMAGym.com, and MMA Worldwide Magazine. Special thanks to my guests again, Jeremy Padower from Jack's Pacific, and Fred Edish, who is going to be fighting this weekend in Minnesota. So stay tuned next week for another big show, and don't forget to head over to TheFightNerd.com. So hopefully by then we'll have the highlight video of the New York Mixed Martial Arts Expo up. At some point this week, if not next, I'm going to try and get some good videos up despite this downtime. Once again, I am the Fight Nerd, and thanks for listening.